fighting him, but then he threw down the gauntlet on another fight. He said he won't sign their housing affordability bill unless they support his elections bill. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. U.S. farmers hope for some relief from high fertilizer prices with the Strait of Hormuz reopening. I'm A. Martinez.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The USDA predicts energy and fertilizer prices won't go down substantially until next year. At the World Cup, Iran plays Egypt next, but Iran's team is under pressure at the World Cup for more reasons than the next match. Plus, the downside of receiving a Michelin star. It is Thursday, June 25th. Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor is 72 years old today. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Search and rescue teams are pulling survivors from the rubble this morning after two powerful earthquakes struck Venezuela less than a minute apart last night. NPR's John Otis says the epicenter was west of Caracas, but the destruction stretched across one of the country's most densely populated regions.
From photos and videos, the damage looks quite extensive. You can see huge clouds of dust rising into the sky over collapsed buildings and rescue workers pulling survivors out of the rubble on stretchers. People were ducking for cover under tables at restaurants and dashing out of their homes into the streets.
NPR's John Otis reporting. Officials say at least 164 people are dead as rescue crews continue searching through collapsed buildings. More than 900 others have been injured. Acting President Delcy Rodriguez has declared a state of emergency, urging people to remain alert for aftershocks. Secretary of State Marco Rubio is touring Gulf Arab states to discuss an interim peace deal between the U.S. and Iran. NPR's Aya Betraoui reports Rubio is wrapping up his visit today with a summit of Gulf foreign ministers in Bahrain after stops in the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait.
Rubio says he's in the Gulf to thank Arab states for their, quote, incredible support throughout the war and to engage them about decisions going forward. Iran accused Gulf Arab states of allowing U.S. forces to launch attacks from their territory during the war. Iran targeted these countries with missiles and drones that hit bases, but also energy infrastructure, airports, and residential areas. Despite this, Rubio says the security partnership remains strong. The interim agreement with the U.S. focuses on curbing Iran's nuclear program. Its missile and drone capabilities are not part of the deal. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
A coalition of publishers representing nearly 400 newspapers has filed a lawsuit against OpenAI and Microsoft. It accuses the companies of stealing copyrighted material to build artificial intelligence models. NPR's John Ruwitch reports.
Plaintiffs say this is the biggest coalition of local newspapers yet to sue OpenAI and Microsoft for violating protections under the Copyright Act. They say the companies systematically and willfully stole copyrighted news articles to build AI products like ChatGPT and Microsoft Copilot. The case is the latest in a raft of lawsuits accusing AI companies of scraping copyrighted material from the web to train models. The coalition includes Pulitzer Prize-winning publications like the Riverdale Press and the Concord Monitor and the New York Amsterdam News, one of the oldest black-owned newspapers in the U.S. OpenAI and Microsoft did not have an immediate comment. John Ruwitch, NPR News.
This is NPR News in Washington. The head of the U.S. Postal Service says the agency is responding to an executive order by President Trump by proposing not to deliver mail-in ballots in states that refuse to turn over their voter list to the federal government. NPR's Hansi Lowong reports the proposal is facing multiple lawsuits that are trying to block it.
At a hearing on Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan asked Postmaster General David Steiner about President Trump's order. It calls for the U.S. Postal Service to maintain lists of eligible voters.
If a state refuses to turn their absentee voter list over to the federal government, will the Postal Service still mail their ballots under this proposal?
Under our proposed regulation, no.
Five lawsuits by Democrats, almost two dozen states and voting rights groups are arguing the Constitution gives power to state legislatures and Congress, not the president, to set federal election rules. They also argue the Postal Service has no authority to refuse to deliver ballots to voters because they are not on a list. USPS is a financial supporter of NPR. A court ruling on whether to block Trump's order may come as soon as this month. Anzila Wong, NPR News.
A new AP NORC poll finds most Americans face scam attempts every day, and nearly 3 in 10 say they've lost money or personal information. A separate Gallup survey found about 1 in 10 U.S. adults said they or someone in their household lost money to a scam last year, with nearly half losing more than $500. Both surveys found few victims reported the scams to federal or local law enforcement. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
When you tune into KEXE, you'll hear our phenology students reminding us to pay attention to nature.
Hello from Mr. Masakovic's class at Baxter Elementary School. This past week brought our first substantial rainfall on one day.
Canadian thistle has popped up.
Greetings from the fourth grade phenology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Eliza,
Charlie, and Mary
reporting on our observations for the week ending May 1st.
This week, we observed our lilac have many sets of leaves on it.
Hi, this is Carson
and Reese from Crooked Lake Elementary School in Andover, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center for April 29th through May 1st. The weather was sunny but cool with a high temperature of 48 degrees Fahrenheit.
This concludes the phenology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
KEXE celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. President Trump shocked Washington yesterday when he blew up plans to sign the widely supported legislation to lower housing costs across America.
The president said he won't support the measure until the Senate passes his sweeping elections bill that so far Senate leaders have said just does not have the votes to pass. That's just the latest example of his frustration with those who won't follow his lead. Not only is the president showing his frustration with the Senate, but also U.S. allies around the world.
I just want their loyalty. We don't need their money. We don't need anything. We have the most powerful military in the world by far. But I just want loyalty. You know, we're so loyal to them.
NPR's Franco Ordonez has been following this. Franco, it feels like the president was celebrating Festivus at the Capitol with the airing of grievances. What can you tell us?
Yeah. First, he really abruptly canceled a popular bipartisan achievement in Washington that both Republicans and Democrats wanted. Really a rarity these days. It was, you know, a bill that focuses on one of the most important challenges Americans are facing right now, and that's affordability. But Trump was just not having it, saying that his pet issue, this election bill, had to be first. I mean, it really was kind of like a Serenity Now moment for some of these senators. You know, Trump later went into closed-door meeting with some of those senators and expressed frustration with those who rebuked him on the Iran war, actually prompting them to reverse course later in the day and vote against a similar war powers resolution that they had approved earlier in the day. And then finally, in a meeting with Mark Rutte, NATO General Secretary, Trump went off on European leaders who he felt did not support him enough in the war against Iran. As we heard, he said he doesn't want their money. All he wants is their loyalty.
So on that elections bill, John Thune, the Senate Majority Leader, has explained that the votes are just not there to overcome a Democratic filibuster. Does President Trump not understand how the Senate works here?
You know, it's not clear if he doesn't understand or if he just doesn't care about the norms and procedures of the Senate. I mean, Trump is more focused on having Republicans loyal to him than having a majority who can pass his legislation. You know, as you pointed out earlier, this speaks to much bigger issues about expanding his executive and political power and the loyalty he expects from those he works with. You know, that, of course, includes the Senate, who he ripped into earlier in the day over Iran, and, of course, withheld support from the housing bill that could have helped the party in the fall elections. But it also extends to foreign leaders, which we also saw yesterday. After Trump criticized European leaders, Rutte, the NATO chief, was clearly trying to maintain ties between Trump and the rest of Europe. I mean, just showering him with praise and only delicately pushing back when Trump criticized those allies.
There must be political implications, though, especially with the housing vote.
Yeah, I mean, it speaks to the divide in the Republican Party just 5 months from the midterms. Republicans have been clamoring for Trump to turn from Iran and focus on domestic issues, to focus on the economy. And then here you have them delivering to his desk something that addresses one of the things polls show Americans are most worried about, the cost of living. It would probably help him in the polls. It would help the party. And he doesn't sign it. I mean, House Speaker Mike Johnson is expected to meet with Trump today to go over some of the challenge Trump faces with Capitol Hill Republicans, but it just gives Democrats another example that they can point to and argue that Trump is focused more on election fights and not on kitchen table concerns.
That is White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Thanks a lot, Franco.
Thanks, A.
Let's go back to President Trump's dust up with the Congress and what difference could it make? I'm going to ask Alex Conant. He works closely with Republicans as a strategist. He's been a communications lead for several presidential and U.S. Senate campaigns, and he's with us now. And he's also a senior partner with Precision Strategies. That's a public affairs firm. Alex, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so Senator Bill Cassidy seemed to confirm the media reports that there was a shouting match with President Trump during yesterday's lunch on Capitol Hill. And people might remember that Trump did help defeat Cassidy's reelection bid when he endorsed his primary opponent. But then the senator turned around and changed his vote on the War Powers Resolution, as did Rand Paul, who voted present. So what does that tell us?
Well, I think it tells us that things got pretty tense yesterday at the Senate. As Franco was just saying, all the senators, House Republicans as well, thought that they were going to be there to celebrate with Trump a rare bipartisan bill on their number one issue in the country, which is affordability and specifically housing affordability. And instead, Trump was more focused on the upcoming elections, his voter ID law, canceled the bill signing, and then went to lunch with the Senate Republicans, where he lectured them for an hour about a vote earlier this week about the War Powers Act. And it sounds like Bill Cassidy wasn't having it and spoke up and got into a bit of a shouting match with Trump. This doesn't serve anybody good. And I think there's recognition on both ends of Pennsylvania Avenue yesterday afternoon that this is not how we want to run the Republican Party. J.D. Vance, the vice president, invited Bill Cassidy to the White House last night. They had a conversation. And then after that, Bill Cassidy returned to the Senate and basically reversed his vote from the day before on the War Powers Act and supported the president, which they had done previously as well.
So look, if you're a Democrat, like, the campaign ad writes itself, doesn't it? I mean, you know, from their perspective, you know, the president wants to make it harder for you to vote rather than make it easier for you to live. So how do they compensate for that?
Yeah, I'm not sure they're going to conflate the two issues, but there's no question that affordability is going to be the defining issue of the midterm elections. And even 6 months ago, White House officials were telling me, we have to win the affordability argument or we're not going to win this election. And so that's why they passed the housing affordability bill. I think it's important to note this housing affordability bill will almost certainly still become law. Trump has not said he's going to veto it, and if he doesn't sign it, it automatically becomes law in 10 years. In 10 days. So I think this will still become law. You'll still see Republicans running on it this fall. It's just a whole lot messier now that they didn't have the signing ceremony with the president to run in the ads with him.
Sure. But I'm saying you don't conflate the issues, but if you were a Democrat, you certainly would, wouldn't you? You certainly would. You'd say that's what his priorities
are. Sure,
the president was specifically asked, why is this more important to you than signing this bill?
The Democrats are going to say he's more focused on redecorating the White House, on rebuilding the East Wing, on the reflecting pool, on the Iran war, than what voters care about. Of course, we know Democrats are going to be doing that. And frankly, it's a very salient message, which is why Republicans are trying to strengthen their own arguments about the effectiveness of our tax cuts, possibly doing more tax cuts later this fall, and this housing affordability bill. They want to say, no, we are doing things to lower prices. Meanwhile, as Trump expressed with the great reservations, oil prices are coming down. We expect gas prices to come down soon. Inflation is relatively moderate, aside from the last couple of weeks where we had the Iran war, which hopefully is coming to a conclusion. So I think the White House's hope is we can make things more affordable before this fall and salvage the midterms.
So talk about that Save America Act, if you would, for a minute there. Why is this so important to the president, who is, after all, a lame duck? He can't run again. Does he genuinely believe that Republicans can't hold on to the House or the Senate, for that matter, without it?
I think he genuinely believes that the 2020 election was stolen, which I know most of your listeners don't believe, but the president does believe that. And so I think he views this bill as an acknowledgement that if it is signed into law, that there's problems with our elections. And that's why it's so important to him. Also, I think he's laying the groundwork to say that the midterm elections, if they don't go well for the Republicans, were also stolen if this bill wasn't passed, which I think is why it's another priority of his. This bill would federalize elections effectively, which ironically is something that Democrats have long supported and Republicans have long opposed. Republicans have taken a more federalist approach, saying that elections should be run at the state and local level. Trump thinks that the state and local elections are letting officials elections be stolen. He feels very strongly about this. But it would also require
expensive citizenship documents to register to vote. It would also impose a lot of new requirements. So is that... We only have about 30 seconds left. So the Republicans who oppose it, why do they oppose it?
Because they believe in federalism. They believe that states and local governments should continue to run our elections, that we shouldn't federalize elections. This is a very consistent position for most Republicans. Also, in order to actually pass it, you would have to blow up the filibuster in the Senate because you need 60 votes, and you still have a lot of Senate Republicans who simply don't want to change the institution's rules.
Just really 10 seconds here. Is this the kind of fight that actually resonates with voters out in the field? Like, if you go out and do polling, are people noticing this?
Probably not, but they do notice the affordability issue. And if the failure of Republicans to deliver on affordability issues, especially if Trump were to veto this bill, I do think it's something that breaks through.
That is Alex Conant. He's a Republican strategist. He's with Precision Strategies. Alex, thanks so much.
Good to be with you.
President Trump is testing the limits of his power with an executive order to restrict voting by mail. That order calls for the U.S. Postal Service to play a role in determining who can receive mail-in ballots. Here's NPR's Hansi Lo Wang.
President Trump's executive order is facing 5 lawsuits and so far has not directly affected mail-in voting for this year's primaries.
Postmaster General Steiner, the Postal Service's proposed vote-by-mail rule...
But this week on Capitol Hill, Democratic Senator Gary Peters of Michigan grilled David Steiner, the head of the Postal Service, which is a financial supporter of NPR. USPS is proposing to use information from state election officials to create lists of approved absentee voters, as called for by Trump's order.
So yes or no, if a state refuses to turn their absentee voter list over to the federal government, will the Postal Service still mail their ballots under this proposal?
Under our proposed regulation, no.
This and other proposals for Trump's order are now under review by federal courts. For lawsuits by Democrats, almost 24 states and voting rights groups, they argue the Constitution gives power to state legislatures and Congress, not the president, to set federal election rules. Senator Peters asked Steiner about another claim by the order's challengers, that USPS has no legal authority to regulate who can vote by mail and how.
I would have to defer that to the courts to understand the authority.
Well, I think it's clear that there's nowhere in the Constitution, there's no federal law that the Postal Service is authorized to create these types of voter databases, ballot verification systems, or mandatory standards. It just simply doesn't exist.
Trump himself voted by mail in Florida in March, and the president has said he issued this order to stop illegal voting by non-U.S. citizens in federal elections, which many reviews have shown to be incredibly rare. A federal judge in Boston is expected to rule soon on whether to block the order. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Good morning. It is 6:19. We've been listening to Morning Edition. It's here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Coming up next, we're talking fishing. Some big news from Jeff Sundin, not just weather and fishing patterns and how the weather's affecting it, but he'll be telling us about some changes on his boat. Stay tuned. We are seeing some dense fog this morning. A dense fog advisory is in effect for locations along the Iron Range. It's looking like the Grand Rapids all the way to Ely and Big Falls, Big Fork, International Falls area. Visibility below quarter mile possible. Slow down, allow extra time if you are traveling. And looking at the Weather Service, they are giving a little update on next week. They're describing it as hot and stormy. But we are looking at today, our temperatures, 74 to 77. Tonight, mostly clear. Temperatures in the upper 40s to low 50s. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with highs in the mid to upper 70s. Overnight lows 52 to 58. Saturday, Beltrami block party day, partly sunny with highs in the upper 70s to low 80s. Breezy southeast winds up to 25 miles an hour, and evening temperatures in the upper 50s to mid 60s. Coming up at 8:10 this morning, we're going to be talking to Aaron Brown about summer. Summer on the Iron Range, the time of polkas and parades and politicians. Summer is ramping up. We want to know about small town events or festivals you think everyone should experience. Maybe it's museums or parks or historic sites or ice cream shops or parades. Text us 218-326-1234. We receive support from L&M Fleet Supply, carrying a variety of products for your next outdoor adventure with 13 locations across the Northland. More at lmsupply.com.
Gone fishing. There's a sign up on your door.
Pops, don't blab it around, will you?
Gone fishing.
Keep it shady. I got me a big one staked out.
You ain't working anymore.
I don't have to work. I got me a piece of Gary.
Cows need milking in the barn.
I have the twins on that detail. Each take a side.
But you just don't give a darn.
Give them 4 bits of cow and hand lotion.
You just never seem to learn.
Man, you taught me.
You ain't got no ambition.
You're convincing me.
Gone fishing. Got your hound dog by your side.
That's old Cindy Lou going with me.
Gone fishing. Fleas are biting at his hide.
Get away from me, boys. You're bothering me. Folks won't find us now because Mr. Satch and Mr. Cross, we gone fishing. Instead of just a wishing,
bop baby, bop baby,
oh yeah.
Time to talk fishing on the Thursday morning show here on People Powered KEXE. Jeff Sundin joins us now, our early bird fishing guide. Morning, Jeff.
Good morning.
Well, let's start off. We've got some big news for a little bit in a few moments, but let's start off with the weather and the solstice and how this change in weather is affecting fishing.
Well, I think I'm cautious when I say this because the problem when you've got a working theory is that there are so many moving parts that it's hard to add it all up and make it fit together into a tiny little package, I feel like the lakes have finally turned the corner. We had that delayed summertime. The spring was cool. The early part of the summer has been cool. Water temperatures were staying low. But I sort of last week, midweek or so, I don't expect that everybody reads every little report, but on the 22nd, I kind of put a timeline together. On the 21st, I had written that it felt like something was getting ready to change. The fish weren't really 100% going yet, but it just felt to me the way things looked in the water and the conditions, it seemed like we were on the verge of things picking up. And then somehow, coincidentally, on Saturday, it just kind of all came together in real time. So I was sort of watching, and we started off in the morning. It was a pretty standard fishing day. Jigs and minnows, fishing primarily for walleyes, and not real deep water, 10 to 12 feet of water, so on and so forth. And it started off kind of the way things have been starting off for the last month. We were getting a fish here and a fish there, kind of slow but steady, but it was looking positive. And then as the weather began to warm up, I could see more evidence of fish starting to build up on these, for lack of a better term, you know, we call it a transition area. That could mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But when it comes to like mid-lake structure, and you're usually talking, when you say, use the term transition, it's usually from some sort of a harder bottom, either rock, gravel, even just hard sand, into the lake's deeper mid-lake basin region, where you start to have soft, kind of almost silted over, really super soft mud and loon goo, things like that, right along the edge, what we're referring to as the transition between the two, is quite often an area that's kind of a semi-soft marl. It's got some fragments of snail shells and things like that mixed in it. If you have it in your hand, lots of folks have anchored their boat before, you pull the anchor up, and it's got this kind of sticky stuff on it that's hard to wash off. It feels like it's part clay, part sand, and like I say, a lot of organic stuff mixed in it. So along those regions, that's where the lion's share of the insect hatches take place. And just because we don't see bug hatches on the surface doesn't mean they're not happening, because the larval form of a lot of these critters, it takes, you know, weeks or months for that to develop and mature and finally emerge as a flying insect. So as the day was progressing, I was starting to see some more evidence of that type of activity near, you know, just above the bottom. And then the fish started to kind of move into that, and slowly but surely throughout the day, the bite just got a little more steady and a little better and a little more steady and a little better. And by the end of the day, it felt like we were kind of in a full scale summer peak type of a pattern. That happened again to me on a different lake on Monday. We got some weather that made it a little bit tricky to, it was hard to stay in the kind of structure that I wanted to fish. But when we did have the opportunity, it turned out to be quite a similar thing. And I'm seeing some other reports now. I just happened across a report from a friend over on Leech Lake who was talking about a pretty good full-scale mayfly hatch going on over there. And so I think this is the, and people might be thinking, well, wait, I always thought bug hatches were some kind of a problem. And once upon a time, before we understood them or before we had the ability to figure out where they were occurring, the bug hatch did, you know, we fished the shorelines, and once the fish left the shoreline, it was a mystery where they went. And so in that sense, the bug hatches did cause problems for anglers. But now we have the ability to see the location on our electronics. We have equipment, boats that will allow us to go and fish that kind of structure. So in a lot of ways now, these insect hatches, they serve to gather first the bait fish and smaller game fish, and then as that population builds, then the larger predators kind of come into the area. So even fish that aren't actively feeding on insects or insect larvae, they still gather in the area to capitalize on other small fish that are feeding on it. So builds up this entire food chain kind of on mid-lake structure, serves to kind of consolidate where everything is happening. So you have a relatively small territory to search through instead of having to look over the entire shoreline and all the flats on a lake. Now you can focus on deeper water points, mid-lake bars, humps, freestanding structure where it can be quite easy to spot the fish on your electronics. and the presentations are pretty straightforward for being able to catch them. So the summer peak, the term summer peak, I think it has begun. I think we're in it, and each day along the way, I'll gain confidence if the patterns start to hold up. So that's kind of where I think if you want to know the answer to the question now, well, okay, so great. So what do I do about it? Basically, you just have to make a few adjustments. We've been fishing primarily with jigs and minnows throughout the early part of the season. This is the time where the jigs and minnows, fish still remember being up in the shallows, and they still remember feeding on minnows. They're always going to work to a certain degree, but as these insect hatches mature, the leeches, night crawlers, slip floats, things that kind of emulate or capitalize on the feeding preferences that have to do with these insect feeding frenzies that they go into will start to become more effective presentations for us. The demonstration that I mentioned on Saturday, we started off jigs and minnows with the best. Eventually, we switched over to leeches, which I think was turned out to be the overall best presentation throughout the day, but we also got them fish using jigs with night crawlers and even a couple of fish using slip floats with leeches and a couple of them with a half of a night crawler. So basic change now is the presentation more than anything else. And like I said, locations would be pretty straightforward. Almost everybody has got at least some rudimentary electronics now that can allow you to go and find these transition areas, which will look something like kind of a hard, if you're using your 2D sonar, it'll look like a harder, more solid return. And then as you move into deeper water, you'll see that bottom structure doesn't look quite as solid on your graph. If you're using down imaging or side imaging, it will appear kind of as the harder bottom is a sort of a shiny, bright, shiny appearing spot compared to a duller, you know, faded out gray or even black region where you're running to be softer bottom. So a little bit of practice. And I'll do a good job now going forward through the week of posting some images of what these things look like on the various graph readings, because that's a good clue to how to find this type of structure.
And so it's getting towards summer peak. You've been catching all kinds of things, been people on the boat catching walleye, northern?
Just because of my business, I guess we're primarily focused on walleyes, but along the way, we have been catching, it seems like this year in particular, northern pike have kind of been on fire. At times when you couldn't catch anything at all, the northerns are still cooperative. They've been just plain biting all the way through. And depending on the lake, dictates whether you've got some opportunity for larger fish. You know, we fished some of the Clearwater lakes in Grand Rapids last week, and there you have a potential for catching some nicer sized fish. Well, if you fish Bowstring or Round Lake or some of the shallower lakes, folks already know you get a lot of them, but they're typically not the best. And if you're looking for certain eating size fish, it can be okay. The smaller fish on some lakes, we can get some 20 and 21 inch fish and use those for blackening, or I had one crew that saved a bunch of them for pickling. It doesn't take much imagination to tell you that, you know, you can go out with a piece of plastic on a jig, you can use a jig and minnow, you can use a live minnow below a bobber, you can troll spinners. Almost every presentation that would put like in the top 10 most popular, for at least for the moment, you're going to be able to pick off enough northern pike to be satisfied. Panfish are starting to respond to that kind of as we see the water temperatures warm up now. It looks like we've got a warming trend coming up. We should begin to see more numbers of crappies and sunfish. We're catching some by trolling spinners in and around the vegetation now, cabbage patches, coontail. We did fairly well one day, a nice rainy day last week, over the top of eelgrass, which is a nice, perch seem to like that structure. Whenever I find these flats that have got eelgrass on them, I have a better than 50 chance that there's going to be at least some keeper perch in that region. And they're a little bit cooler water fish. They seem to be showing up quicker. And then I think the panfish within the next week or so will start to see them. You know, I associate anything from about the 4th of July until mid-August now, I think, is this kind of mixed bag trolling with Little Joe spinners or make your own spinner. Very inexpensive, you know, fathead minnow. Not a super complicated presentation at all. And we're just on the verge of that beginning. So the multi-species maybe not quite into full gear, but this summer transition for walleyes and pike definitely is going. And I honestly haven't had enough opportunity to fish bass to be able to put my finger on what the trends and patterns are. I have a report going on the website this morning from a friend down in Brainerd. He says the Brainerd area lakes bass fishing has been really good. And so I think that's probably on the horizon for us in this region too. We're not that far behind Brainerd when it comes to weather patterns and water temperatures.
All right, now I don't want to steal your thunder, so I want you to tell us the big news.
Well, how about if I start by saying I really don't think it's thunder. I think it's more like if you could picture Jeff Sundin as one of these small dogs that doesn't really want to go for a walk, but if you pull me on the cord, you can get me to walk.
Okay.
So I have been gotten to walk.
All right.
It wasn't so bad when it comes to the forward sonar. It wasn't too bad when I was the last fishing guide in the region that didn't have it. But when I started being in my customers, the people who fish with me, when they've got it and I don't, It was starting to get a little more complicated. And then it was the step of people starting to single out, like, I'm not going to fish with you. I'm going to fish with this guy because he's got it and you don't have it.
Wow.
So from just a business point of view, I did finally buy it. And we've talked quite a bit over the years about angler ethics and, you know, ethical behavior, so on and so forth. So I did. This was sort of an expensive proposition to me because, unlike some people who could, you know, I probably could have parlayed some of my ability to share things, you know, on the media and so on and so forth. I probably could have parlayed this into some sponsorship opportunity and gotten somebody to provide. But if I have that, if somebody is, you know, providing me with the equipment or paying me to use it, now I have an obligation to do certain things, including, you know, to promote it for the purpose of, you know, trying to get people to buy it, you know, so on and so forth. So I purchased it with my own money, and it was expensive. I wasn't real happy to do it this way, but from here on out, whatever I say about it can be whatever I really believe about it, rather than somebody is, you know, paying me to be interested in. So
sure.
We're talking about forward
facing sonar. So you.
We are, yeah. I think I mentioned it, but yeah, it's a good idea to highlight that again. That the subject of being able to capture fish more easily. Now, in my particular case, I don't intend to use the forward sonar. In fact, I haven't used it a whole lot. I've had it for about 3 weeks now. The first 2 weeks of it was me pulling my hair out, just trying to get the thing to work at all. It wouldn't do anything. And there's a lot of elaborate rules. I had attempted to get some input and advice from Garmin about their unit. People kind of regard Garmin as the hands-on favorite, you know, for most of the pros. But, you know, Garmin was really unresponsive, and they didn't want to even talk to me to give me any advice or anything. So I've been using Humminbird for a long time, and I decided, okay, I'm going to go with Humminbird's version of it, and that's what I bought. But I have to say, their version of the transducer, what they call the MegaLive transducer, in order to calibrate that, you have to have calm water. The boat can't be moving. You have to be between 15 and 25 feet of water. You can't have any electronics on, including the spot lock trolling motor. And if you don't follow all those rules, you can't get that transducer calibrated. It's really a dumb way to make something, because people can't find that kind of circumstances out there. Eventually, I did finally find a nice calm spot, and I got the thing calibrated and working. And so now I can at least see fish on it. And I do have to say there's been a time or two so far that I would have not, there's, you know, a handful of fish that we would have not caught if I wasn't using it. But for me, I'm primarily just using it to, like, confirm what I've already seen. You know, we've all had side imaging now for a long time, and obviously the down imaging sonar, which has been around for a really long time, if you know how to read that equipment, you already have a pretty good idea if there's fish in the area or not. For me, the lakes like Leech Lake or Cass, Winnie, where the zebra mussels combined with other things that have helped clarify the water, the fish have become so shy of the boat that you have to be able to spot them and see them before. You can't cross paths with them, or they just swim away. So this is where the forward sonar is really helping people. They can see the fish before they come to them. They can stop the boat and then approach that school of fish from 30 or 40 feet away in order to try and catch a few of them before they become alerted and move away. So that's my plan going forward. And then for me, some other things that I've been concerned about and we've talked about before. I was reading an article. It featured Gary Roach, and he was kind of reflecting. This subject comes up now pretty often, the forward sonar. And he was reflecting on every step along the way, the very first electronics, the green box, you know, the movement to want to ban that, you know, get rid of it because of it was an unfair advantage. And then the paper graph was an unfair advantage. In 1999, when we had the governor's opener here in Grand Rapids, the big controversy at the time was the underwater camera, and the legislation was in the works to try and ban the use of the underwater camera. And in those days, the camera had come out not too long after we had begun to use the GPS. And on that governor's fishing opener, I can remember Jesse Ventura looking at, I had one of those underwater cameras in the boat, and I was using the GPS to go from spot to spot. He pointed at the camera and he said, "Why is everybody worried about that?" Then he pointed at the GPS and said, "Look at what you're doing, going from one spot to the next on this GPS." He said, "That's what they should be worried about." And at the time, he didn't even realize that he was right about that, but he was, because the advances in the charts, being able to follow the map around on the lake and know where every little spot is, nothing can be withheld anymore. There is no such thing as Uncle Howard's walleye hole. It's because everybody knows where it is now. It's all on these maps. And that was probably the single development that made anglers the most effective at being able to locate fish. So, chart going forward, to try and speed up the story, Gary Rohr says the one thing that all of these technologies have in common is that there's a human being using it. And so the point is the human behavior is whether, if there's an issue with something, it's going to be the human behavior that creates the issue, not the technology. And so this is a theme that, we keep coming back to over and over again on this program. You know, how you use it is the important thing, not what you're using. So your tools are one thing, but your approach to how you use the tools is a whole other ballgame.
And that sounds exactly like the conversations going on about AI right now.
Right. That's absolutely right. That's even a little bit scarier. I'm sensing that we're probably going to run short on time here. Now,
yeah.
We're going to talk about a couple more things, but let's pick back up again
where
we're leaving off, because there's more on the subject of not just the forward sonar, but technology in general and the catch and release culture that I'd like to talk about. Maybe we can start with that next week.
Sounds great. Thanks, Jeff.
You bet. See ya.
See ya. You can read more at Jeff's website, jeffsundin.com. We'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts? Do you have forward-facing sonar? You can text 218-326-1234. We've got National Native News coming up next. We're learning about the Iron Dog race. For next year, they're planning to add 3 checkpoints. It is the world's longest and toughest snow machine race in Alaska is where it takes place. Stay tuned for that story, and we've got the set list and a lot more here on the Thursday Morning Show.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. It's billed as the world's longest and toughest snow machine race. Next year, the Iron Dog Race plans to add 3 checkpoints to its over 2,000-mile course. As KOTZ's Desiree Hagen reports, a new race route, announced earlier this month, has been several years in the making and crosses through 2 national wildlife refuges.
The new route adds the communities of Hooslea, Shugnak, and Ambler. Rick Paquette is the executive director of the Iron Dog. He says it won't add miles, but would traverse through new terrain.
This isn't something like overnight that happened, you know what I mean? This was over 7 years in the making. This is a really big deal, and we're super excited to do this.
The proposed route passes through federally protected land, more than 100 miles of it, through the Koyukuk and Selawik National Wildlife Refuges. Both refuges rejected the initial request, stating that the race would be a public safety problem, require more budget and staff than are available, and doesn't align with the refuge's purpose or mission. A letter from Selawik Wildlife Refuge said that a portion of the proposed route would also violate ANILCA, the Wilderness Act, and the Wild and Scenic Rivers Act. The managers of the refuges were unavailable for comment. Iron Dog appealed the rejections in June 2025 and reached out to Senator Dan Sullivan's office. A press release from the senator said he and his team played a key role in advancing the new route and drafted an appeal that, quote, highlighted inconsistencies, preventing the route's expansion.
Anytime you have a bunch of different organizations that you're trying to collaborate with and get one final answer on, it's extremely difficult. You know, new administrations and definitely, you know, Senator Sullivan's office really helped push this over and help us.
Paquette says Sullivan's office helped with letters of support and with multiple organizations, including the Bureau of Land Management. And it paid off. In December, Regional Director of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Sarah Borio overturned the previous denials, allowing for the new race routes. Borio's office did not respond to questions from KOTZ News. Paquette says there's challenges with a race this large, which passes through 23 mostly remote checkpoints.
I mean, it's a beast to put on this race logistically, and there's always struggles with fuel and getting equipment out and getting, resources out there.
Both Ambler and Shugnak have experienced prolonged fuel shortages in the last several years, often in winter when storms can ground fuel planes. Still, Paquette says Iron Dog is prepared for those challenges.
you know, we do our best to make sure we get all the resources to the communities that we need to put on a strong race.
Paquette says Iron Dog has several programs that the new race communities will benefit from, including free helmets and free life jackets for local youth. Last year, Iron Dog established the Iron Pup program, which fosters young racers. Iron Dog also founded the Make It Run program that partners with schools and engineers to encourage technical and mechanical training. Paquette says there's also economic benefits to the new communities.
Sure, yeah. I mean, there's going to be publicity. There's going to be people going through these areas. You know, we send resources up there, spending money and giving, you know, a chance for these folks to see this incredible race.
The Iron Dog race typically begins in early February. A date has not been set for next year's race. Reporting from Kotzebue, I'm Desiree Hagen.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
Down in the factory, they're making jealousy. How they package it, and they make it cheap. It's easy to buy. They sell it worldwide. It's even overseas and at the university. Down in the factory, down in the factory, down in the factory. Down in the factory, they're making apathy. It's easy to find. Sometimes you get it for free. You can rent it to own, or you can buy it on loan. And if you ain't for sure, well, you can take the tour. Down in the factory, down in the factory, down in the factory. Down in the factory, they're making gluttony. They got two for one, minus the battery. Put it together, step by step. Well, your head stays dry, but your feet get wet. And it's made to last, they got a warranty. Customer satisfaction guarantee. They make anxiety, and it's easy to feel, but it's hard to see. They sell it door to door. Yeah, you won't have to leave. You can turn out the lights and play make believe. Down in the factory, down in the factory, down in the factory, down in the factory.
Listening to here?
Oh, you know, well, that's Eric Koskinen.
Yeah.
He is coming up this weekend for the Beltrami Block Party. We've got a great lineup of both local and statewide musicians on the lineup, including Eric. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Frog in my throat. And David Huckfeldt, who, fun fact, Eric and his band are going to be playing with David for David's band.
Oh, fun.
And they're super excited because they're longtime friends.
Sure, yeah.
And they don't usually play shows like this.
Both of these guys are, they're great touring musicians. You know, I know we always use the word troubadour for Charlie Parr, but these guys are troubadours too, out on the road. And they, like, I had a chance to talk to David Huckfeldt at that Star Tribune event.
Yeah.
You know, and they, he and someone like Eric Koskinen, they also value places where they can play music, places where their music is played on the radio.
Mm-hmm.
They love KXE and the mission of what KXE is doing. And it is, musicians are, I mean, you'll find that with lots of musicians, but when the sort of purposes are the same and then you love the music too,
yeah,
it's just, and it's free.
It's free. Open to everyone. We've got the Headwater Science Center. We'll be doing some a bubble station as well. So very much family friendly music going on starting at 1 o'clock, lasts until 9 o'clock on Beltrami Ave all day long. There'll be food and beverages out there as well for you. And if in case of rain, we'll be moving it inside to both Bridget's and Keg and Cork with music kind of in both places. So
little fun fact, I get to be there with a superstar. I'm going with Julie Crabb.
Oh, okay. So
look for
if
us.
If you see Heidi and Julie Crabb, mm-hmm, are you guys going to hold up arrows or anything? Like, look, we're right here.
That sounds very Julie-like, doesn't it?
Totally.
No, I'm excited. It should be a lot of fun. Great. I'm excited to meet folks, listen to some good music, be outside, mm-hmm, summertime. That's kind of what we are talking about in this week and next week, too, as we move into the 4th of July. Our friend Aaron Brown's going to be joining us at 8:10 today, talking about, he is doing some reporting on the festivities. The Iron Range is sort of a quintessential 4th of July area where all the politicians are there and the parades and the polka musicians and all the things are going on. So Aaron's going to, I'm sure he's going to wax poetic about some of his, I believe, didn't he and Christina meet at a street dance? Something like that.
Oh, that sounds right.
Or at least it was, you know,
a part of their story.
Yeah. So we'll be talking with him about 8:10. And then we want to hear from you as well. You can text us this morning about the things going on in your town that we shouldn't miss. 218-326-1234. It doesn't just have to be your town. Could be one town over or this place you know you always end up going.
Well, and I've been in the Longville and Reamer area a couple times over the last week and have seen so many signs. They've got this massive July 3rd party going on as well in Longville. Kat Perkins, I think, is going to be there.
She's, oh, wow, like that from music. The Voice.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, you know, that was unexpected. I've been seeing posters for all over.
She's got one of those powerhouse, mm-hmm, just kind of, she would do covers of like Heart.
Oh, that seems right.
And
yeah,
blues songs on The Voice. Yeah.
Was this a while ago that she was? Okay. Because I feel like this was an era that I maybe did see a couple episodes of.
Yeah. She's kind of just a rocker chick.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Talented.
Yeah. So text us in your community events that you make sure to attend every single year.
Mm-hmm.
That is, you know, if someone's not from the area, they should go check it out for a little slice of Americana.
Even if, you know, growing up in the Brainerd area and with the parade there, that is the hugest thing ever. Even the little tips about what time to go to put your chairs in front of the courthouse.
Look at that.
You know, things like that are really super important. I'm telling you.
For sure. Especially for new people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So send in your tips for area events. Text us 218-326-1234.
Coming up, we've got some info on live music, but first we'd like to thank Harmony Food Co-op, Bemidji's full-service downtown grocery store, offering people a variety of local, organic, fair trade, and conventional items. Open daily 8 to 8, harmonyfoods.coop, also on Facebook.
We also receive support from Dragonfly Coffee, located in Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids, featuring a scratch bakery, offering espresso, bubble tea, and more. Empowering inclusion and community through employment. Special orders available and more at drinkdragonfly.com.
This is The Setlist on KAXE, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at one show Friday and two block parties Saturday, June 26th and 27th in Aiken, Grand Rapids, and Bemidji. Friday night, Allure is playing at Sampaguita in Aiken at 6 p.m. It's the in-your-face femme rock project of classically trained vocalist Elizabeth Tondour, who put out their terrific debut album, Blood Running, in 2023, full of catchy hooks and Gondour's skewering of gender roles and toxic masculinity. It's Allure this Friday in Aiken. There are two block parties this Saturday, and we will start off in Grand Rapids with the Pines Birthday Block Party beginning at noon. Taking place on Northwest 3rd Street in downtown Grand Rapids, the festival will feature performances from singer-songwriters Diddy Wish and Lane Newman, jazz from Sam Miltich, and the globe-trotting sounds of Tattletale closing out the night. The Pines Birthday Block Party all Saturday in Grand Rapids. And then in Bemidji, KAXC, KBXC, Bridget's Irish Pub, and Keg and Cork are presenting the first Beltrami Block Party at 1 p.m. on the 300 block of Beltrami Ave in downtown Bemidji. Six Minnesota musicians are on the lineup, with the Americana and rock fan favorite Eric Koskinen, folk rocker David Huckfeldt, and the